Good afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Athenaeum of Philadelphia on a spectacularly pleasant afternoon. We should have done this out in the park, although I don't think the slides would work as well. As presumably every single person in this room knows, the American Philosophical Society was founded by Benjamin Franklin in 1743, is the oldest learned society in the United States, and is an institution of international significance. APS promotes useful knowledge in the sciences and humanities through research, publications, professional meetings, library resources, and in other ways. Today, we're going to hear about the past, present, and future of APS from its executive officer, Robert M. Hauser. It is a distinct pleasure for me to introduce Bob Hauser. Dr. Hauser is the Vilas Research Professor and Samuel Stouffer Professor of Sociology Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has been an investigator on the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study since 1969 and directed the study from 1980 to 2010. The study, which began as an examination of post-secondary education, has followed the lives of more than 10,000 Wisconsin high school graduates of 1957 for 60 years and has become a national resource for biosocial research on health and retirement. While at Wisconsin-Madison, he directed the Center for Demography of Health and Aging, the Institute for Research on Poverty, and the Center for Demography and Ecology. To conclude with a quite partial list of his honors and accolades, Dr. Hauser is a member of the United States National Academy of Sciences and a fellow of the American Statistical Association, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the National Academy of Education, and it almost goes without saying, the American Philosophical Society. Join me in welcoming Bob Hauser.
Thanks very much, Peter, and I'm delighted to see so many folks here this afternoon, including the chap who just walked in here, John Van Horn, from whom I cribbed a lot of the limited knowledge I have about this place. So let's get on with it. And this is going to be, maybe it's going to be a horror, because I couldn't resist doing more and more. So there are 45 slides, and I'm going to race through some of them, just so you know. So here's this wonderful plaque, which is somewhere on our property, and it gives you a hint of the complicated history of this organization. As you likely know, Mr. Franklin founded the Junto in, 1727, the Library Company in 1731. Then he founded something called the American Philosophical Society in 1743, which immediately fell into a completely moribund state until there was the Young Junto, which began in 1750, then got reorganized as the American Society for Promoting Useful Knowledge in 1768, and then all of these outfits got together. Mergers are really kind of a big thing in this whole history, and called themselves the American Philosophical Society held at Philadelphia for Promoting Useful Knowledge, which is literally the legal name of the organization. There were endless back and forths then about when this organization actually began. And as recently as about 100 years ago, the declaration was that it was 1727. Actually, even before that, in the mid 19th century, there was a big hoo-ha, and it was declared that it was going to be 1743, which gave them an excuse to have a centennial celebration in 1843. And then it was decided it was 1727, and as recently as 1941, I believe, it was finally decided, who knows if it's final or not, that it would be 1743. So with that in mind, we are just completing the 275th anniversary year. And I say that with some accuracy, because it was actually founded on May 14th, 1743, which means we're less than a month off right now. So here's Franklin's proposal, in which he declared that men of virtue might get together to exchange various ideas and findings and promote useful knowledge. This actually wasn't his idea. It was actually John Bartram's idea. And Bartram tried to sell it to this other fellow who was the Englishman who was very important in the genesis of a lot of scientific activity in the United States, Peter Collinson. He was the guy to whom Franklin, he was actually a bookseller, but he was the guy to whom Franklin sent his notes about electricity, which we had on display last year, and that got Dr. Franklin his doctorate, so to speak, through his election to the Royal Society. So several years went by between the time Bartram had this idea and the time Franklin succeeded in persuading people that this actually was a good and viable idea and started the organization, which shortly faded away. So here are Ben and Deborah. And if you visit my office in Philosophical Hall, you will find both of them on the wall. It's a long, narrow room. Franklin is on the north end. Deborah, and this is the only known portrait of Deborah Franklin, is on the south end of the room. And what I was told when I came into that office for the first time was that they were always ordinarily at least that far apart. This is a bad line, the one on the top there, at least the one on the top, but I've been trying to figure out some of the history here. And the histories of these historic institutions and of their buildings are richly intertwined. And I can't even begin to outline, for example, all the things that went on involving potential sales of Philosophical Hall to the city or to somebody else and efforts to build a building on the parkway, which never came about, and so on and so forth. And I'm going to skip that stuff. And then, of course, these things are all involved with Dr. Franklin. I will leave you to read this. Basically, the idea is that almost every one of our great historic institutions met somewhere else at some time in its history. And in fact, if you look at the bottom line, the present APS Library Hall, built in 1959, so it's our most modern building, is in part a replica and on the same site as the original library company. And the Athenaeum was founded in 1814, but for most of half a century, it also met at Philosophical Hall, the home of the APS. So all these histories of movement and location are just incredibly intertwined and complicated, and sometimes not entirely free of conflict. So here's where you probably recognize Carpenter's Hall on the left, and that's where the first place where the APS met, although it met in other places, including Franklin's home. And here is the present and only permanent residence, Philosophical Hall, completed in 1789 with a loan from Dr. Franklin, or it would not have been completed. It has an odd history. At one time, maybe 60 or 70 years ago, a third story was put on it so that the library would have room to expand above it. And it was only in 1948 and 49 that it was finally torn off because it was so ugly and completely inconsistent with the architecture of the Independence Hall. And here are two views of the library, but not the library that currently exists. The one on the left is sort of the left half of a print, one of the famous William Birch prints, showing Library Hall as it existed, and it came up, it went up in about 1790, only a very short time after Philosophical Hall. And here is a picture of it, a photograph of it, around 1880 or 1882, shortly after the building was demolished and an office building, the Drexel Building, was built on that site. Now, there's the same 1882 picture of Library Hall, and on the right, that's the current library. So you can see that the architect, our architect, more recent architect, has really done a splendid job of making the front of the building look very much like the original library company, including a copy of the Lazzaroni statue of Benjamin Franklin wearing a toga. Some of you may have seen him about a year and a half ago, wearing an Eagles flag, but that's not a permanent attribute of Dr. Franklin. So, and the early APS members included just about all of the founding fathers, and for reasons that utterly escaped me and our record keepers as well, a number of them, some of the most famous ones, were elected twice, once in 1781 and again in 1790, and it's a mystery why that was done, but it gives you some indication of how well the records were kept. Franklin was actually the first president of the APS, but he was a pretty old man by the time it came out about, and then he spent the revolutionary period in France. So he really didn't have that much to do with the origins of the organization as a really active organization. Rittenhouse did a pretty good job as the second president, but he died in 1796, and he was succeeded by Thomas Jefferson, who was president of the APS at the same time he was either, throughout the time, that he was either vice president or president of the United States. So he had kind of a dual presidency. And in fact, there's a lovely little book that I may drag out later, a little sort of pamphlet-sized essay about Jefferson's work at the APS, which has been written by our librarian and newly elected APS member, Patrick Spiro. And that period of Jefferson's life and his involvement with the APS, I guess, is overshadowed by his vice presidency and presidency, because his wonderful, many wonderful biographers basically pay no attention to that. But at that time, the APS was kind of a locus for people who agreed with Jefferson's politics. And I'll let it go at that. Here's the first woman elected to the APS. She was a pal of Dr. Franklin, so I should say he had another kind of involvement that I hadn't mentioned yet. And it took another 80 years before any other women were elected. The next three elections of women took place in 1869. So Jefferson had all of these interesting things go on while he was deeply involved with the APS. He sent Lewis and Clark to the APS for instruction and supplies and medication and the like before they undertook their great journey west. The medications included Dr. Rush's mercury tablets as purgatives. And apparently they were very effective. They called them thunderclapper pills. And one of the other wonderful things that Mr. Jefferson did was to bring his interest in Native American languages and anthropology to the APS. He had the idea that he could follow the population history of Native Americans, which he was afraid would soon disappear under European settlement, by recording their languages. So he made up word lists of common words that he thought would be common in any language, and any chance he got, either personally or with help from other folks, he would arrange to send out copies of this word list and then get the phonetic version of the Indian languages transcribed. And by the time he left the presidency, he had a huge chest filled with these papers. Lewis and Clark had contributed mightily to that collection during their travels. And he left Washington for Monticello and his retirement, during which he thought what he would do would be to write this great history of language, of Native American languages. And he left the trunk on a barge on the James River in Richmond, partway to Monticello, and some thieves came by. And that was the biggest, heaviest object among Jefferson's belongings. So they took that. Needless to say, they were not really impressed with the contents, and so they dumped them into the James River. And our library has a few scraps of those papers that Jefferson was able to collect on the riverbank the following day, but that's all that's left of that collection. However, one of Jefferson's successors, Pierre-Stephen du Ponceau, of whom I will say a little bit more later, actually took that up again, became a linguist, and began the modern collection that we have and that is very active at the present time. Another hero of the early years was Peel. He was the subject of our exhibition in 2017-18. Actually, it was he and his family, his successors as well. He was an extraordinary guy, and he actually lived in Philosophical Hall at one time with his enormous number of children. How that worked, I don't know. And then Peel's Museum, the first great natural history museum, was for a while in Philosophical Hall and then outgrew it and moved over to the second floor, I believe, of Independence Hall for many years. John Vaughan is another great early hero of the APS. He was a wine merchant. He had a place on Front Street, I believe. He gave away a lot of money, and he lived in Philosophical Hall and was treasurer and librarian for many, many years, as you can see on the slide. His picture, too, by the way, is on my wall, my office wall. And there's du Ponceau. He came over here from France at the age of 16 to help in the Revolutionary War. He survived. He became a lawyer and linguist. He was not only an expert in Native American languages, but also in Chinese, and made substantial contributions to the study of that language, and was president for close to a quarter of a century, and then revived Jefferson's Native American Language Project. This is a picture of him, supposedly a portrait of him. I think it's rather flattering at age 72. But there's another one that immediately follows, which is in our collection. It's an early daguerreotype, I'm told the first ever done of anyone wearing glasses. And he was not in really good shape at that time, and this was shortly before he died. And the photographer, or whatever you called him, was a chap named Robert Cornelius. So later in the 19th century, the society did a number of things: Arctic explorations, dinosaur finds, photographs of Western tribes. As I mentioned, the 1869, they elected three eminent women scientists, and then late in the century began the Phillips Fund for Native American Studies, which still exists and supports such studies at the present time. But things actually, in some sense, went downhill in the second half of the century. Whoops, am I going the wrong way? Yes, here we go. Here are two more heroes of this later period. Alexander Dallas Bache. He was a great-grandson of Benjamin Franklin, and a member of the APS, and likewise Louis Agassiz, the great student of fish fossils. And the reason I say they're sort of heroes is because they were the leading creators of the National Academy of Sciences in 1863. And so the question I put to our former librarian, Marty Leavitt, was, why not here? I mean, here we are. And he said that it was too far between Washington and Philadelphia at that time, which is, by the way, the same reason that John Adams went off to Massachusetts and created the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, because it was too far between Boston and Philadelphia. Anyway, so that's enough of the past, and I'm going to turn to the present and the future. This is our little celebration of the of our history. And if I don't know if you can read the bottom line, but we have a timeline electronically that's on our website that shows, that goes through the entire history of the APS, and it is just about to go live in the lobby, on a screen in the lobby of the library. So every, and you can find it there if you can't find it online on the website. So before I go too much into the present, I want to acknowledge those who have made the present what it is. So Annie and Mary and Linda and Nora, would you all stand up, please? Okay, so there you have in a row membership, meetings, research, and publications, and those are the people who make it happen at the APS. In any event, we had our first major bequest in 1931 from a geologist named Penrose. We started giving research grants in 1933, and that has become the major way in which the APS now produces useful knowledge. We built Library Hall in 59. We bought Franklin Hall in 81 and Richardson Hall in 1999, and we began the modern museum exhibitions in 2002. The membership has grown, even as the age has grown of the membership. And between 1987 and the present, we've gone from about 540 to 840 resident members. That still makes us much smaller than any of the other learned academies in the United States. The National Academy of Sciences has about 2,600 members, and they're changing their election process in a way that is likely to lead to an explosion in membership. And the American Academy of Arts and Sciences has upwards of 5,000 members. So this is a fairly exclusive club. The wonderful thing about the members, in my humble opinion, is that everybody, and I can speak as a member of all three of those, everybody in the APS believes that everybody else deserves to be there. This is not true of some other organizations. Okay, enough of that. So here are our wonderful recent acquisitions. Kitty Corner from Philosophical Hall, right next to the amazing Hotel Monaco. I originally entitled this Philadelphia, the City of Failed Banks, but one of my colleagues didn't think that was the right thing to do. So we're talking about repurposing here. And actually, Richardson Hall is going to be repurposed in a very serious way, because the second floor of that hall houses our museum department and also a kind of a sibling organization, the Consortium for the History of Science, Technology, and Medicine, which is a spin-off of the APS. But the first floor had a business consulting firm on it. We ended that that lease just about a year ago, and we're thinking of very productive ways to reuse that space in ways that will be more productive for the society. So today we have all of these different schemes going: members, meetings and travel, research, publications, museum, library, etc. And I'm going to say a word or two about most of them before I close. So here we have the fields of membership, five classes: mathematical, physical sciences, biological sciences, social sciences, humanities, professions, arts, and affairs. Women are now about a quarter of the members. And then we give away a bunch of prizes on occasion. One of the things that makes the society, keeps the society free of interdisciplinary quarrels, is that every class has the same election quota. And again, that's not true of all other organizations that I'm familiar with. So here are a few members. Some of you may have known them or know of them. Herman Goldstein was one of the early computer scientists responsible for creating the ENIAC. And you can see him there with a bunch of tubes in front of him. The great Barry Blumberg, who developed the vaccine for hepatitis B, among other things, and was later president of the organization. Goldstein was executive officer, same position I'm in. Ralph Bunche I've put in there because he was the first black person elected to membership. And that was, I think, shameful if you think about distinguished black folks more historically in the United States. But he was elected only in 1950, and there are now quite a number of black people in the society. And then Linda Greenhouse, our president, you may know her as the former Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, who now writes a biweekly column on the Supreme Court for the Times. Here's Maxine Singer, who is one of the leading molecular biologists of our time, very much involved in regulating something which is no longer, in some sense, capable of being regulated, but she was very much involved in the early years of recombinant DNA research. And Vera Cooper Rubin, who recently departed, who discovered dark matter and was ignored throughout much of her career, one might argue, for gender-related reasons. Since we're at the Athenaeum, I thought I should throw in a few architects. So here are Todd Williams and Billy Chen, who are among my favorites. You may know, of course, that they designed the new Barnes, among other things, and the recently departed I.M. Pei. And here are some local folks, Ned Montgomery, Doty, and Clyde Barker, and then Linda Greenhouse again with her husband, Gene Fidel. And here's another, one of our most remarkable members in the foreground. Forget the guy in the sweater in the background. But the chap sitting down who has only recently departed at the age of 101 is a man named Walter Monk, who was known as the Einstein of the seas. He was elected to the APS in 1965. So he is, at least in recent times, our longest standing member, and was just an extraordinary guy, an extraordinary human being, and an incredible scientist. He basically figured out how waves work. In fact, one of his early accomplishments was advising the Allies on wave action, predicting wave action before major landings during World War II. Here is one picture of our meetings. This is the kind of serious part. Here's another picture of our meetings because we call this organization Ben Franklin's Thinking, Drinking, and Eating Society. And it's all true. And a few new members, Hopi Hoekstra does experimental work in the wild on the evolution of rodents. Orley Ashenfelter, who's an old friend of mine, is the Dean of Labor Economists in the United States. And Frances Arnold, you may have seen her if you ever watched The Big Bang Theory. She was on one of the last editions of The Big Bang Theory. But she does directed evolution with enzymes. She's a chemical engineer of extraordinary capacity. So in research, we give away about 200 small grants a year. And these are heavily reviewed, even though they're quite small. We have about 200 peer reviewers a year. They're given in every field of study, but tend to focus on people at or near early careers. And to give you an idea, this map, the little red dots on the map show the locations in which our Lewis and Clark Fund has had scholars doing field work for the last dozen years or so. It's quite impressive. And then our publications, we have the Proceedings, which is our journal, and it's an open submission quarterly, but it includes meeting presentations and biographical memoirs, that is to say, obituaries. But the press has been continuously operating since 1771, which makes it the oldest, longest continuously operating scholarly press in this country. We have our transactions, which tend to be relatively short monographs, which we now issue only in paperback. Occasionally we reissue some. The center item here, the essays by Ben Franklin, are a collection of two of his essays that were published in the transactions early in the life of the society. One describes his discovery of the Gulf Stream, and the other some improvements in the design of the Franklin stove. And here is our latest memoir. Memoirs are big books. How these things got these names? Proceedings is clear enough. Transactions? Memoirs? I don't know. But anyway, this is the Jay Stiefel's wonderful book about the based on the log of a cabinet maker, an immigrant from England, who worked here and just did marvelous work between 1718 and 1753. We have this museum that's in Franklin Hall. A lot of our last year, the exhibition on the left, and by the way, the chair there is Franklin's library chair, and it has a little fold-out thing inside it, which you can't see very well in this view, which enabled him to use it as a step stool in order to reach books on higher shelves. And that little exhibition, in part due to thanks to the fact that the Park Service let us put a little sign outside the back door of Philosophical Hall, which of course enters the courtyard of Independence Hall, and it says museum. So we get a lot of people coming through. We had 130,000 visitors last year, and we're ahead of that this year for our new one, Mapping a Nation, which is about the art and science of mapping and also the role of maps in political conflicts in the early history of this country, which was, maps were really central to that. So the library is completely open. It's a research library. We have something like 13 million manuscripts, 250,000 books. The library, independently of the research department, has about 40 long and short-term fellows every year. We have what's called the Bibliography Project, which is basically an effort to catalog all of the works of members of the society from its throughout the 18th and 19th century. And that turns out to have been a much more difficult and long task than we might have anticipated. I think we're in the mid-19th century now, and we've had two postdocs working on it for the past year. So that's going to go on. We have the Center for Digital Scholarship, which does neat things like we have just recorded or transcribed digitized a logbook that Ben Franklin kept from 1748 to 52 when he was postmaster of the city of Philadelphia. And it gives us a lot of interesting network information because we know where all of the letters came from and to whom they were addressed. And we have conferences. In fact, we have a network conference coming up at the end of this week. I think there's an open session on Thursday night with a keynote talk. And it's sort of built on this. It's networks from Ben Franklin to Facebook. And we've had recent conferences on the past, present, and future of libraries and on the art of mid-19th century revolutions. So we have these three core collecting areas now, American history, of which I'll say more, science, technology, and medicine, and Native American languages. And of course, we have a number of treasures. And I'll show those. Here's one. Well, you can't. Oh, yes, this is the Declaration of Independence. It's in Jefferson's hand. It's the penultimate draft of the Declaration of Independence. And the interesting thing about it is that it contains two passages of strong anti-slavery language, which were excised by the Continental Congress in the final version. The one that's most interesting is the one that I tried to show in that little in the little extract on the right. It was, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with inherent and inalienable rights, and that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Inherent was deleted, and instead it was certain inalienable rights. Inherent would have meant at that time, certainly, and perhaps now as well, from birth, which could not have occurred under slavery. And then there was a longer passage condemning the slave trade that was cut as well. And here's a document that was only discovered behind a wall in the 1960s. And it's about a kind of a pre-Lewis and Clark expedition to the West for which Mr. Jefferson recruited a chap named André Michaud. And it was failed because by the time he got to Kentucky, there were rumors circulating that he was a French spy. And this was a very sensitive time, 1793. So that did not go forward. However, this is the only known document which contains the signatures of all four of the first presidents of the United States: Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Madison. And then, of course, Jefferson gave us the journals of Lewis and Clark. So we have those as well. So what about tomorrow? Well, at the end of next week, not this week, we're going to have an international symposium on the future of learned academies, where there will be representatives of some, it'll be 30 or 40 people representing something like 21 learned academies from around the world. And we will be talking about some nuts and bolts issues, but also about the standing of science, learning, knowledge, facts, research at the present time. And there will be a public session at Franklin Hall on the night of June 13th, that where we'll have a panel discussion among five of the leaders that will be moderated by Mark Thompson, the man who runs the New York Times. So that's one of the things that's coming up, and we plan to do more such, have more such events in future years. We are also reorganizing the society to integrate the library and museum. And the reason for that basically is that a few years ago we decided that rather than renting things for our exhibitions at great cost, we would rely on our own collections. And that meant really tying the work of the museum much more closely to that of the library. And so that is a major undertaking that will take some time to work out, but is, I think, going to make us more efficient and effective and so forth. And that involves creating new spaces. I mentioned Richardson Hall. We will be moving our museum artifacts into the library building. We will be putting compact shelving into the bottom two floors of the library storage areas. We'll be moving our fellows into a common area to encourage greater interaction among them. Actually, we will house our fellows and those of the Consortium for the History of Science, Technology, and Medicine all together. And then the library has these various centers. We have had for the last couple of years a Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. We just completed a matching grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, on the Humanities, that will give us an endowment for that. We don't want to have or have a History of Science Center because in some sense the Consortium for the History of Science, Technology, and Medicine already does that for us, but we are going to have several fellows who are operating and are using our collection specifically in the areas of that history. Then the big news that came out last week is of a partnership. We are bringing the collections of the David Center on the American Revolution from Bucks County to join the collections on that, about that same era in the APS library, and creating a research center, a major, actually the only such center in the country for research on the era of the American Revolution. That's a rather big deal for both organizations. The upshot of that is that the David Center will actually, the David Library will continue to have its own board, but they will make regular grants to the society and for work, the work of the center. And we will have a group of historians, distinguished historians, about eight of them, serving as a steering committee to decide on programmatic activities. And one of the effects from the APS point of view is, and that also involves this library museum integration, is that we will have a lot more in the way of public outreach and educational activities than we have in the past, and particularly in collaboration with the Museum of the American Revolution, whose leadership is also represented in the way in which we're organizing all of this. So, that's it, folks. And I have to thank some people who are departed and some people who are very much with us. As I said, I've cribbed heavily from the essays of John Van Horn, from the history, the brief history of the society that Ted Carter wrote, from the long essay about when the society began that Stephen Peter Duplantseau wrote, from our museum director, Merrill Mason, our librarian, Patrick Spiro, from John Vaughan, who wrote his own exceptionally brief history of the APS. Of course, it was still kind of young when he wrote it. And Mary Grace Wall, who gave me all sorts of visuals. She works on the museum and does a lot of the really hands-on work. And then a woman named Madalena Veras, who was responsible for creating the timeline that I mentioned earlier. So thank you very much, and I will be happy to take questions.